We continued on around the hillside until, suddenly, we found ourselves standing before a valley with steeply sloping sides. In the distance we could see the sea and a good stretch of coastline. We decided to sit down and rest a while, in order to catch our breath. The grass was wet and it looked as though it might rain again at any time. We put up the umbrella that we had brought with us and began once more to climb. We had gone only a few steps when our attention was caught by a soft, low-pitched humming sound. We looked up and saw a large disc circling high above us as if searching for a place to land. The agility with which the flying object moved was truly remarkable. It had no burning lights, and seemed to be dark silver in color. We felt oppressed, as though our whole bodies might be crushed. Tina cried out, "Raphael, what is the matter?" I tried, by means of cosmic contact, to ascertain just why we had this strong feeling of pressure, which by now was causing us no small amount of anxiety. The stifling feeling grew more intense. Then the disc withdrew into the distance, and immediately we began to feel well again. The voice of Raphael spoke to us, "We wanted to let you experience this sensation of pressure, in order that you might better understand how you must undergo a certain amount of purification and reorientation of your life energies with each new meeting with us. Your planet is in an impure state because the heart of man is impure. The earth is out of harmony, and disintegrating vibrations, like the scourges that lash her sorrowing multitudes, create ever-widening zones on the planet where the life energies are undermined. One day you will comprehend the reality of these conditions which are beyond the grasp of your limited science. Those few who have begun to realize the true situation are misunderstood and left alone." I heard what Raphael was saying to us and was fearful, lest the sensation of stifling oppression overtake us again. "Now we are going," came the voice of Raphael from the disc. "Follow the path. We will meet again farther up." Because of the rain and the mud, we continued the climb with considerable difficulty. The wet grass was slippery, and we grasped at the lush growth to pull ourselves forward. At last, we came to a broader footpath that led to a little meadow. We had scarcely arrived when we saw the disc, standing there on the ground just a few dozen meters from us. I was surprised to see that it seemed level in spite of the sloping ground on which it rested. This was apparently accomplished by varying the lengths of the supporting members between the disc and the three-ball landing gear, thus maintaining perfect balance. "How wonderful!" Tina cried out. Between us and the disc, a few meters distant, stood Raphael. The rain had noticeably decreased, but this man from space did not seem to be the least wet. He greeted us heartily and came closer. "It is good to be able to meet with you up here," he said. "What a beautiful spot on planet Earth this is." Tina called our spacefarer's attention to the fact that our visits almost always seemed to take place in the rain. "That won't always be the case," answered Raphael, "but the Earth must be cleansed. Much water will yet have to flow, and not that alone." Tina then said that she was really very happy, and that the rain seemed to be quite a normal part of our meetings, that she understood the idea of a needed cleansing very well, which this indispensable natural element illustrated so perfectly. Raphael invited us to listen closely to the voice of the rain. He said that mankind was more and more losing its sense of oneness with nature. To regain this perspective, he continued, would be the key to being healed of many of the evils that now plague mankind. We stood in silence. Only the whispered patter of raindrops falling on leaves and grass could be heard. Yet, in the drenched surroundings and the grey atmosphere, there was a quality of vibrant life because of the presence of this being. If the people of Earth do not return to a state of peace with creation, and do not learn to relate harmoniously with nature, she will not reveal her heart to them. They will not be able to develop further, in spite of all their scientific discoveries. True knowledge, which the higher development of the Creator's children brings with it, includes the reality of the infinitude of worlds within the universe, which reaches far beyond the realm of only material dimensions. Your science, which researches matter only, and does not concern itself at all with that which goes beyond it, can lead you only to a knowledge of the superficialities of creation, with the great danger that the most important part will be overlooked. This is the reason why your achievements are constantly misapplied. By this time the rain had ceased falling and we had again put down our umbrella. Raphael was leaning lightly against a tree, and every so often he would sweep the scene with a look of keen intensity, as if in wonder at the blossoming plant life all around us. We suspected that our meeting might be drawing to a close. Raphael invited us to come with him a little way in the direction toward the spot where the disc was resting on the ground. "Your science," he continued, "must learn to recognize its limitations. Matter cannot be master over matter. When man is awakened to the fact that true knowledge comes in other ways as well, science will also be a help on the chosen path. So, as you now are, and wish to remain, we will never be able to give you higher knowledge. You would want to use it for your purposes of human power, and therefore in dangerous ways. To that end you are even prepared to bring about disorder and pollution in the region of space surrounding the Earth. You will find us vigilant, however, for it will not be permitted that you should unleash death and destruction over the whole planet." We walked slowly together across the meadow. Raphael, tall and majestic, was between Tina and me. His step was light and sure, his shoes seemed to be made of a material that was copper-colored and as light as a feather. He wore a fairly tight-fitting space suit, also of a coppery tone. "You belong to the Brotherhood of Universal Love," I said. "What, then, is the meaning of your statement that you would not allow dangerous Earthman to expand his activity unchecked into outer space?" "Our methods are peaceful," he answered. "If you nevertheless insist on going ahead with your war plans or make false peace proposals behind which you hide other intentions, you will not succeed, for we will not allow it. First, you must learn the way of goodness, of universal justice and of love. Only after that can you do as you please." "If I understand you correctly," I responded, "this means that you would never use force to deny Earthman access to outer space, but you would in some manner make it impossible for him to violate the purity of outer space by means of the nuclear bomb and other polluting devices which may be sent out from the Earth." "Right," he answered. "And that is also according to the universal law of God our Father." He paused for a while and then went on to say that we would find in our scriptures that the children who were rebellious against the universal Father's love were given a certain boundary beyond which they were not permitted to pass. "Only for the righteous, the children of goodwill, does the Father set no boundaries on the paths by which his children come to him. The planets of the whole cosmos," he said quietly, "belong to universal love. They feel bound to one another in a competition of love and cooperative service. Every brother feels like a brother because he is the child of a Father Creator. Knowledge does not mean might, as with you, but more cooperativeness, more humility, more loving kindness. Love means giving, without asking anything in return. Receiving is included in the idea of love, but it is not the reason that motivates us to love one another. On Earth one misuses knowledge to rule over a brother. All too often one who stands higher up promotes injustice, and forgets what it is like to stand down below. The only might that we recognize is the beneficent power of the Heavenly Father. The only true power is that which springs from love. True knowledge and responsibility lie in service, goodwill, humility, and simplicity, in view of the immeasurable grandeur of the universe." Tina responded with a commentary on how far we Earth dwellers were from realizing such a single and wonderful existence. She said that what Raphael had been telling us about life on those planets that belong to universal love was the dream of so many Earth dwellers who long for peace and justice. "Many of Earth's people," Raphael observed, "pay no attention to the universal laws of creation, nor do they accept them. Others have perverted these truths, and complicated them in ways corresponding to the hardness of their minds, teaching the people to take on burdens which they could not themselves carry. This too has been spoken and written about. Thus, Many Earth brothers do not obey the divine laws because they are true rebels, and others, because they do not believe them to be genuine and just. Bad teachers of the laws therefore have much to answer for with respect to their own brothers. The scriptures are very strict with such persons. I said, in response, that I seemed to recall that some of the truths which he mentioned were taught to us by Jesus of Nazareth almost 2,000 years ago. If you report these, my words, to your earth brothers, said Raphael, you will find a few who say that all this is just a fairy tale. Others will say to you that, since the same message was given 2,000 years ago, they see no necessity to repeat it now. They will say there is no need to reveal these truths because they are already so familiar to them. To such persons, one can only say, hats off. If Earthman had really learned these teachings and translated them into actual practice, we would not be here today to bring you this warning. But we have other words for you as well, other things about which we wish to speak. Let your spirits not be too troubled, for many are waiting to hear our words, and will rejoice in them. We stopped momentarily beside a very unusual bush. Raphael stroked it while he spoke, and treated it with the respect one might have for another human being. Tina had again put up the umbrella, since it had begun sprinkling once more. Raphael paid no attention to the water falling on his head. His hair stayed dry, and that made me believe he was being helped by some unusual form of energy. The earth, began Raphael, as he tenderly touched the flowering bush, was the Garden of Eden, which is spoken of in the scriptures. Eden is the whole cosmos, which has remained true to the love of the Creator Father. There came a time when the people of Earth wanted to eat of the knowledge of good and evil. This was forbidden, since it would bring harm to that which had been created. The Father had given his warning. Mankind, however, did not wish to believe that warning, and so began to experiment with living after its own desires, and with that, the cycle of our present time was begun. You, who had eaten the limitless fruits of universal love, wanted to enjoy one single fruit, namely to try the pitiable way of wrongdoing. Moreover, you said the way of universal love was monotonous and tedious, and thus traduced the story of God's divine creation. Men began to put the bad in the place of the good, selfishness in the place of love, war in the place of peace, and decadence in the place of progress. He went astray, and for that he also gave the Father the blame, who, in his love, has given all his children the wonderful gift of free will. So the word was fulfilled, which stated, if you eat of this forbidden fruit, you will surely die it. An expression of great seriousness came over the face of this brother from the universe, reflecting his profound inner anguish, and this touched me to the depths. Tina looked at him with an expression of anticipation. There was something about his radiant countenance that awakened within me a feeling of hope. His cheerful tranquility, and the warmth and loving kindness in his look gave promise of a way of salvation. How will it be possible, asked Tina, to overcome a condition that has already existed on Earth for many thousands of years? It has all been written, said Raphael, as he resumed walking. Everything that might eventuate from the freedom of choice of Earthman was foreseen, and his salvation was provided for through a great plan of love, corresponding to the justice and goodness of universal law. Rebellious man will never be abandoned, rather, he will be given support. He will be led, he will be chastened and comforted. There will come a time when the one to whom is given power in heaven and on earth will come with his own, and then the rule of evil will be ended, as has been ordained. God the Father will know how best to deal with those who are not yet ready for salvation. We will then not be able to do anything further. We will carry out the new plan of the Father, which he has carefully prepared, but for those concerned, there will be great sorrow and anguish that they did not understand how to make use of such a great opportunity of being rescued. He was silent for a while. Then he added, we are the cherubim of the scriptures. We were appointed by God himself to be guardians of Eden. Never will we allow Earthman to have access to the unspoiled Eden world, as long as he has not changed from the spirit of the power of the bad, back to the spirit of universal love. travel to the space of other worlds is denied you through the justice of universal law. First, you must totally renounce the bad. Then the earth will again be the Garden of Eden, and the people of earth will be accepted by the Universal Brotherhood. This great hindrance will be removed, and we will return and be able to move freely again about the earth, and you about our dwelling places, as it was before the rebellion. Tina smiled and said she wished that day would soon come. Raphael read my thoughts and repeated what he had already told us. We, he said with emphasis, will never resort to the use of force. Force always brings on more force, hatred brings hatred, and death brings death. Our weapons are love, discretion, wisdom and patience. We are, nevertheless, far more effective in accomplishment than you could possibly imagine. We will not allow evil to take root in the cosmos, where harmony, love, and the life force reign. From the earliest times we have renounced the allurement of evil. Being a creature with finite limitations brings with it the obligation to trust the Creator, who has given us freedom and dignity. We love His laws, and know that His love opens the way to everlasting life. It is foolish not to want to give up a little, and thereby to miss out on so much happiness. We love God, our Father, because He loves us. He loves us unconditionally, and we do likewise, for this is the proper response. Soon your planet will comprehend this too, and the long-awaited day will dawn for you. I tell you truly, it will be soon. We came to the place where the disk was. That means, Raphael concluded, that the cherubim will soon be among you. Earth will again be a planet of universal love, and no longer in the power of evil. We will take you with us in space and you will visit other worlds in your spaceships. You will seek out the many mansions of the Father's house, and the new age of love will put an end to the many thousand-year history of war, death and tribulation. Here the meeting ended. Raphael bade us farewell and made his way toward the spacecraft, which was now in sight. We would have liked to inspect it more closely. Raphael turned and said that he was sorry that he could not grant our wish at this time. Through the portholes we could see the faces of two beautiful beings within the disk. We greeted them with a wave of the hand and they returned our greeting. The door closed silently after Raphael. Then the white light came on at the top of the dome. We heard a low humming sound, and saw the three ball landing gear attract into the craft, which now hovered with a gentle rocking motion in the air. There was a rustle of leafy boughs, and the shrubs bent low as if pressed by a sudden gust of wind. We experienced a slight pressure in our eardrums, and the disc lifted straight upwards, then turned in flight, and disappeared quickly in the clouds above. Chapter 6. The Mothership from the Stars. We drove through Sportono, at the western edge of the village. After crossing a bridge over the highway, we started up the steeply inclined road before us. There was a tang of freshness in the air, such as is known to all who travel the countryside at this beautiful time of the year. We drove for several kilometers amidst pines and shrubs, green with the touch of nature in springtime. Meanwhile, the night was falling rapidly. The mountain tops were only faintly visible in the soft glow of the evening sky. The clouds disappeared and stars took their places in the heavens. The air smelled fresh and clean, washed by the recent rains. I brought our friend's car to a halt at a convenient spot and told them to wait there, in accordance with the instructions we had been given. Then Tina and I drove on farther. We drove for a short distance under the trees, away from the main road, then parked the car and went on by foot. Since it was now dark, we had to light our way by means of a flashlight which we had brought with us. Tina said to me that if it had not been for the brothers, she would never have ventured forth to such an out-of-the-way place at night. She found the going very difficult, since her shoes were unsuitable for such conditions, and we held each other's hands for support as we tried to avoid the puddles and the mire. After we had gone on like this for quite a long while, we began to be aware of voices. We stopped immediately in order to listen more closely. We could hear the voices of both men and women. "It is they," said Tina. "I am sure of it. They are already here. I was almost sure that it was they, but, since I was not receiving mental confirmation of that by cosmic contact, I thought it wisest to proceed with caution. I asked Tina not to speak loudly, and to go very slowly. She, however, was full of joy and showed no fear whatsoever. We came to a long row of bushes that formed a natural hedgerow bordering a large level area, which remained hidden from view. We went along it to the end, where we came upon a rather large meadow. Now and then the call of a night bird pierced the stillness. The air had become noticeably fresher, so that we were glad to be able to don the pullovers which we had brought with us. With the aid of our flashlight, we looked over the clearing before us as best we could. It was uncultivated, and divided down the middle by a strip of tall grass, the two halves of the field being on different levels. We pressed on through the wet grass. "I sense that they are here," Tina repeated. "I feel certain that they are nearby." I insisted that she be quiet, nevertheless, and decided we should wait there where we were. Meanwhile, we sat down on a large flat stone that seemed reasonably dry, and waited patiently for some sign of their presence. Then came the voice of Raphael. It was clear, and nearby. "We are already on the ground," he said, "quite close to where you are." Tina was jubilant, and said again she had felt it unmistakably. We turned off our flashlight, and Tina pointed to something barely visible at the end of the meadow, where the terrain rose to a higher level. "Three, there, where the dark border of the trees could just be distinguished, a light appeared, which gradually grew brighter and brighter. The outline of a large cigar-shaped object resting on the ground began to be clearly discernible amidst the darkness." "Oh, how wonderful!" exclaimed Tina repeatedly. We were beside ourselves with amazement, and utterly astonished at the sight before our eyes. The light grew in intensity, and now we could see the thing quite clearly. It was dozens of meters, perhaps 100 to 120 long, and, at its thickest girth, reached almost to the height of the trees behind it. A long row of round portals emitted colored lights that lit up the area where the object was resting. After a few minutes, the whole thing looked as colorful and brightly illuminated as a ship starting out on an ocean voyage. We were spellbound as we watched the play of colored light that now seemed to come from all sides, as if from fountains, whose sources we could not determine. Tina pulled my arm and wanted us to go immediately to the giant spaceship. "Let us wait," I said. "They will surely say something to us soon." We felt the same great joyousness within us that we had felt on the occasion of all the previous meetings. So impressive was this great vehicle from space, that the light-flooded meadow was no longer recognizable. It was as if one had been transported to a new and awesome world. The glow of the cigar-shaped form grew even brighter, and then, before our eyes, began a play of light from the round windows which was truly a festival of luminous beauty. The rhythmically dancing beams of colored light touched our innermost being with a poignancy impossible to describe. Then, from one end of this ray ship came, one after another, four flying discs, so brightly shining as to appear more like globes of white light. They hovered, and gently set themselves down on the open place in the meadow between us and the big cigar. The four small doors opened, and out came men and women. I recognized the form of Raphael, and my heart leapt for joy, so that it seemed caught in my throat. Tina waved a greeting. They came right toward us. Their bodies seemed enveloped in a phosphorescent glow. Raphael was the first to reach us, and the others followed. "Welcome to this place of meeting," he said graciously. "Tonight you will meet other brothers and sisters who work together on this mission." We greeted Raphael, and with him, Orthon and Firkin, whom we had already met. Orthon was distinguished by his erect bearing and noble demeanor. Firkin again displayed that heartiness of manner which had so impressed us before. We shook hands all around. Their looks bespoke sincerity and goodwill, their gestures, an unpretentiousness that was calming and reassuring. Then another brother was introduced to us. He was dark-haired. He impressed us as one whose talents were along practical lines. He was no less handsome in appearance than the others, and his behavior was marked by that same harmonious calmness. "This is our brother, Zol," said Raphael, by way of introduction. "He is greatly valued for his knowledge and ability." Then another man was introduced to us, who impressed us immediately with his kindliness and amiability. He smiled like one who had much to say, but would not speak. "His name is George," said Raphael, nodding in my direction, "the same as yours. This, our brother, lived for a while on Earth, where he chose to come on an assignment. Now he has returned to us." We greeted one another with a warm hand clasp. Then four young women came up to us. We were struck by their gracious charm. The smallest one had blue eyes and light blonde hair. "I am Kalna," she said, "and I am happy to be here with you."
"I am Ilmuth," said the second, as she warmly extended her hand. "This meeting brings me great joy." She was taller than Kalna, and her hair, as black as ebony, fell freely over her shoulders. Her dark eyes looked at us penetratingly. She was beautiful, but along with that, modest and unpretentious, as one could tell by her manner, and by her words, as she spoke to us. Then two more young women were introduced to us, and they were dark-complexioned. We were not told their names. They, too, were a clear example of otherworldly beauty, and of amiability, grace and goodness. The men and women were all wearing space suits with rather full sleeves and trousers. From all, there seemed to radiate a soft glow. "This is a very unusual meeting," said Raphael, in his deep melodious voice. "It is important that you become acquainted with the brothers who are entrusted with this mission. There are many who are concerned about you. You will meet all of us eventually, but not at this time." A subtle, pleasant fragrance filled the air. "What a strange, sweet aroma," Tina exclaimed. "It seems to be not of this earth." I assured her that I, too, had never before experienced so clean and fresh a scent in the air. The brothers smiled. In their presence, we soon felt a sense of trust and intimacy, such as would have been impossible to achieve in so short a time among Earth people. Orthon looked at Tina with such benevolence, and spoke so tenderly to her that she was moved to tears. We all sat down in a circle in the grass, without paying any attention at all to the dampness. "We won't allow you to become sick because of it," Raphael said good-humoredly. "Just make yourselves comfortable." The air seemed milder now, as if warmed by the light energy, and that made our hearts glad. A deep sense of peace left us feeling at one with nature. The spacecraft were like living onlookers. "The inhabitants of planet Earth," began Raphael, sitting relaxed in the center of the group, his legs lightly crossed, "are ready to spend enormous sums of money to join us in space. And yet, we are already everywhere on Earth. We are among you, both visibly, as you see us now, and also in ways unknown to you. Many know of our existence and our presence, yet deny any knowledge of us. Many of those who have seen us insist that we behave in a strange and senseless manner, yes, even that we appear to act contemptuously toward them. Yet they don't want to take that small step that would lead to an understanding of the whole picture and answer your longing to know the whence, where and whither." There followed a period of silence. I rejoiced inwardly over this amazing meeting with these pilgrims of the light, in the stillness of the night. I remembered the words that Raphael had spoken at our meeting at Zogli, and in my mind compared them with what he was now saying. I was convinced that the Garden of Eden had been desecrated beyond recognition by mankind who had rebelled against the Creator Father's love. Just being in the presence of these brothers enabled me to sense and to comprehend so many things. I wished that this night could continue without ever ending. "Some people," Raphael began again, "ask themselves whether we exist at all, and they think, if the extraterrestrials really exist, why then do they not show themselves to, and cooperate with, us in an open manner?" However, many people of Earth know very well that we do exist, and that we do not share their egotistic outlook or wall-like tendency. In reality, they would like to have us in their power, in order to gain knowledge from us which would give them greater opportunities for power and domination.